Ladies and gentlemen, Governor Clifton, the invitation to present to the Southern Nurserymen's Association recent highlights in the field of rocketry honored me greatly, and it is with great pleasure that I speak today to you on the subject, mankind's thrust into space. When I received your invitation to make this presentation, I wondered what mutual interests between nurserymen and rocketmen would exist. But soon I discovered so many parallels of interest that I gladly accepted with the conviction that I can really make a contribution to your association's 60th annual convention. Both our professions are strictly subject to the laws and rules of nature. We have to observe with patience and with diligence the development of our products. But if we conduct our business knowledgeably and with foresight, we might even learn to do things better and faster than Mother Nature herself. We can make things happen under ideal environmental conditions. This enhances our chances of quick and successful results. You do that in your greenhouses and air-conditioned climate-controlled workshops. We do this in our well-equipped research laboratories, also air-conditioned and up to date with latest testing, measuring tools and test fixtures. Chemical science plays a major role in both professions. Our major problems are that of an extended life cycle. This means that it takes a considerable length of time to verify results of latest improvements, and we have this identical problem in our missile work. Years of design, of research, construction, and ground testing are required before a final flight demonstrates failure or success of our experiment. More parallels will be outlined in later parts of my presentation. Your desire to gaze with me into the future shows to me that you are aware of mankind's greatest step forward, which was taken when finally the chains of our gravitational field were broken with the launching of two artificial planets, the Soviet Lunik and the American Pioneer 4. From now on, Earth's life will no longer be confined to this planet. It will spread unto the Moon, into the entire solar system, and eventually, if we can overcome the time barrier, into our galaxy of stars, into the Milky Way, and I hope and trust with new methods and means, even into the rest of the universe. As incredible as this may seem to you today, the future speed of our progress will increase exponentially after existing problems and difficulties have been overcome. Let's realize that only 2 years ago, the humblest of all space vehicles, a small Earth satellite, seemed an almost impossible project. Only 3 years ago, experts were still arguing if our chemical propellants would ever be able to do the job, and if we should not wait until atomic energy had become of age and could be applied to our endeavors. Only 10 years ago, the altitude record of 250 miles for a two-stage rocket was held a brilliant achievement, stood for a number of years unchallenged. Only 22 years ago in Peenemünde, we launched early missiles to demonstrate to some unbelievers that such a heavy vehicle as a V-2 rocket could fly at all, and even without wings. There were many doubters who just could not believe in Sir Isaac Newton's laws of motion, or our interpretation of these laws. all but the Chinese flew rockets as early as 1200. And the discovery of Sir Isaac Newton pointed clearly into the sky about 300 years ago. No one recognized the potentialities until in the 1890s the Russian Konstantin Eduardovich Tsiolkovsky proposed spaceflight by rocket power. At the foretaste of current Soviet-US rivalry, Robert Hutchins Goddard published in 1919 a report predicting that a multi-stage rocket could land a small payload on the moon. From that time on, the military desire for long-range missiles had provided man with better and better hardware. So that today satellites and space probes are just a logical outgrowth and application of existing machinery. This applies to the Russian experiments as well as to most space flights in this country. The only exception, as of now, is the Vanguard project, which was developed for mere space flight purposes. The tremendous successes, however, of the military missiles have proven that even an originally purely military enterprise can enhance and amplify civilian efforts to open up new and exciting areas of peaceful progress in the universal knowledge of mankind. There may well be important military applications for space vehicles. But the history of science and technology reminds us that the future strength of our country is achieved by scientific insight into all the novel fields and by the perfection of our technical skills. This is why our agency, the Army Ballistic Missile Agency in Huntsville, wants to participate in these new explorations. We at AVMA believe that our reliable, deadly accurate, and readily available missiles, after proper modifications, that these are the most suitable tools in the immediate explorations of the universe. ABMA's initial step in this endeavor was made when the Department of Defense directed on 8 November 1957 the agency to prepare for an IGY satellite launching using the Jupiter C as a booster vehicle. On the 84th day of the order, Explorer 1 was launched from Cape Canaveral in Florida. It was 31 January 1958, 10:48 p.m. In the meantime, this Explorer 1 satellite has covered more than 200 million miles. It has decreased its orbital flight time from 114.9 minutes to now a little less than 96 minutes. It is expected that this Explorer satellite will still be in the orbit up to approximately August 1962, that is another 3 years from now. If we calculate the cost of this Explorer satellite by the mile, we come to the conclusion that at the present time the price per mile is down already to about a cent a mile, and by the time where it is expected that Explorer 1 will re-enter into the Earth's atmosphere and will finally fall down from heaven, the cost for every mile done by that time will be down to half a cent, maybe even as low as a third of a cent a mile. You all know and realize how favorably that compares with a family car. Now, to launch our satellites has required up to now rockets weighing up to 1,000 times the weight of the satellite itself. Engineers at many stations are working now on systems to reduce the takeoff weight until they are only 50 to 100 times that of the satellite. The greatest portion of this weight consists of fuels necessary to propel the satellite to its final speed of approximately 18,000 miles per hour. However, if we want to reach the moon and not just send up a satellite, then the need for an even larger rocket in relation to its payload is clearly seen. This rocket has to be accelerated with its final stage to approximately 25,000 miles per hour. This speed is called the escape velocity and would apply to the surface of the Earth, not considering air resistance while the rocket is traveling through the lower layers of our atmosphere. However, rockets do not start suddenly. They accelerate gradually, keeping their speed fairly low while still in the atmosphere. In order to use as little fuel as possible, a rocket should attain its escape velocity as near to Earth as possible. Many engineering calculations have to be performed prior to a space probe launching in order to determine optimum trajectory conditions based on vehicle performance. Accurate timing requirements have to be met in order to meet the moon at the right place and at the right time. Actually, we could reach the moon already with a velocity of only 24,000 miles per hour from the Earth, measured again at the Earth's surface, when our probe is then still 34,000 miles short of the moon. The moon's gravity is then as strong as the Earth's, and any slight velocity over and beyond the necessary one will make it fall down on the moon. If she is in her pre-calculated position, this is often dubious, especially when the excess velocity in the equal gravity region is very small. If the probe crosses this line, however, with too much velocity, it will shoot past the moon, its course merely deflected a little. This is what happened to Lunik and also to Pioneer 4. We rocket engineers rate rockets not in horsepower, as most other people do, but in thrust. This value is expressed in pounds of force and specify the push exerted on the missile by the exhaust gases generated by the combustion of the propellants in the rocket engine. It is this thrust which lifts the rocket initially off the Earth and then accelerates it, thus making it move faster and faster. Most people who have never seen a large-size rocket take off its launching pad are amazed by the slowness of this event. You will see this verified in the films I'm going to show you a little later. Before we get into further technical details, I wish to answer a question which I am sure you have in your minds. Why go to the moon, or to Mars, or to Venus at all? What's in it for us? Here are five good reasons, not necessarily given in the most logical order of importance, but most likely representing a few facts impelling enough to make man journey into the universe at the earliest possible moment. Here they are. 1. Man's insatiable thirst for knowledge. Secondly, man's spirit for adventure. Thirdly, the possibility of related technical advances connected with any such huge and novel venture. Fourthly, international prestige. And fifth, possibly military advantages. We should not forget those. Due to many unsolved problems, such a space program will be very expensive indeed. This brings up the question, will the program get public support? And will the long-term results justify the effort? I myself believe that the public is willing to foot the bill if honest and full information on military, political, scientific, and technological aspects are given. I believe that people are willing to support a reasonable program toward the exploration of space and other important matters with substantial long-term benefits. For this reason, I came gladly to your convention today to present as much information as can be given within security limitations. Beneficial byproducts of our early space programs will be, firstly, communications satellites, Secondly, worldwide television transmission. Wouldn't it be very, very fine if we could have seen Mr. Nixon in Moscow talking to Khrushchev all the time? Thirdly, weather forecasting satellites. Fourth, weather control satellites. I'll say a little bit more about these a little later. Five, training outposts for future manned deep space missions. Sixth, conduct of biological experiments under zero gravity conditions. This list could be continued for a long, long time, particularly if we also consider future space ventures. In respect to item 4, I would like to add this. It is today believed to be entirely feasible to dissipate potentially destructive storms and hurricanes before they become dangerous. This is certainly an appealing endeavor for many. Also, by controlling the Earth's reflectivity and emissivity during summer and winter, we can probably one of these days make the polar ice caps at will smaller or larger, thus regulating within limits the normal water level of our oceans. You people here in Florida know only too well what that will mean, and I only hope that a peace-minded nation in the first one